So this evening we will form sort of a tag team. Christian will speak a little bit first, and David will follow a little bit, and then they'll have a conversation, and then you will be invited to join in that conversation. And I encourage you to do so. So thank you, Christian.
Thanks, Craig, for this introduction. The two previous presentations already had to do with the church season. Easter is coming up, the death of Jesus, at the same time the resurrection that the Christian church is celebrating as a celebration of life. We have decided to have a joint evening presentation, David and I, on the topic of the Gibson movie, the movie The Passion of the Christ, despite the fact that it's now a few years that it came out and certainly was at the heart of much discussions in the church, also out there just in the general world. But it was certainly one of the recent movies that has had a certain impact. And so the ones who have seen it might certainly still be under the impression of the images which we saw there. I did watch the movie once. And so I still think, because of that, it's appropriate to reflect on the movie once more, despite the fact that it's now a few years that it has been released and stirred all this discussion. You'll be getting two somewhat different versions. We both have written articles on the Gibson movie, and so some of, I know at least my reflections that I'm going to present tonight are drawn from that article that I published some time ago. So the title was quite long. I decided to go by a shorter version, but that doesn't mean that this is really the title of the evening. Then what about then The Passion of the Christ? So let's join in some reflections on the movie as well as the Passion of Jesus Christ as we encounter it in the stories of the New Testament. And that means, first of all, in the stories of the Gospel. Now, please be advised that this presentation is rated 18A, and that means, according to the association of what's the thing called, the movie, the American Movie Association, right? This means that parents are strongly cautioned that this program will likely contain explicit violence, frequent coarse language, sexual activity, and or horror. That's simply unavoidable by dealing with this kind of topic. For those of you who haven't seen the movie, I thought it might actually be, and those of you who haven't spent as much time reflecting on it, I thought it might actually be interesting if I do bring up, do refresh our memories a little bit about this movie and some of the aspects around it. So, first of all, I want to say that Gibson, in a way, does represent a theory of atonement. And it is actually his own theory of atonement. There's nothing wrong about it, and other theologians have done just about the same thing. One of the famous theologians in that list of people was Anselm of Canterbury, who in the 11th century wrote and crafted his theory of atonement. And so it's manifest in the book by Anselm, which is called Cur Deus Homo, that's Latin, and it means, why did God become human? And according to Anselm, atonement works like this. Human beings are supposed to be obedient to God, but they are not. And this is actually how Anselm defines sin. Number two, therefore God is frustrated. Human sin needs to be remedied by a certain type of satisfaction. In other words, something needs to be done by which the offense caused by human sin can be eliminated. Now that leads to a problem, according to Anselm. There is no way in which any human could possibly provide the necessary satisfaction to God. And the conclusion is, only a divine being, and that was Jesus, was capable of paying this required satisfaction. You You see, it's all about satisfaction, and that's why this theory is also called kind of the satisfaction atonement theory. You can also tell it is thoroughly rooted in medieval legal structures. That was just all what medieval times were about. And that's why Anselm readily went ahead and used those structures to explain something which was rather difficult to explain, atonement. Now, in this movie, The Passion of the Christ, Gibson also presents his own version of atonement, his own theory of atonement. He doesn't present it in a lengthy lecture, but somehow in the images that come through there. So some of the information on that movie, the movie was directed and produced, also financed by Mel Gibson. The screenplay, by the way, was written by Mel Gibson and by Benedict Fitzpatrick, who I had the pleasure to encounter at some point. So if we talk about the Gibson movie, we should know that actually the story itself was only co-written by Gibson. It was partially written by Fitzpatrick. The financial dimension of this movie was just beyond description. Already before the opening date, tickets for $10 million were sold. Within 3 weeks, the movie had earned $264 million. The investment, by the way, was $25 million. And up to today, the movie has made more than $1 billion. So the financial success is just beyond description, and there's an estimate that half of all North Americans, in fact, have seen the movie. Oh, I should forward this here. Here come the numbers once more. And you see here lots of big bucks. So, if you don't know what that is. But there's a bit more to the success of Gibson. There's actually a Bible edition that came out, and it was done by the International Bible Society, and it actually features James Caviezel, the actor who played Jesus in that movie, on its title page. What does Gibson show actually in this movie, for those who haven't seen it? Well, it's actually just limited to the 12 final hours of the life of Jesus. So it starts with a scene in Gethsemane and concludes with the burial. Flashbacks are interspersed, and the resurrection is only a short coda. I measured it once. It was a minute and 30 seconds. So Gibson presents basically his understanding of how the death of Jesus was redemptive, and that means his theory of atonement. Thus, the movie's contents reflects more or less the passion narrative of the biblical Gospels. Well, more or less. Gibson had the actors kind of speak in Latin and Aramaic. I should maybe mention that, you know, there was never any English version of this. The dialogues in Latin in Aramaic and Latin were somewhat strange because the languages at that time in Palestine were actually different. By the way, when asked why these two languages, with subtitles. Here are the subtitles. Why these languages? Because Gibson and Fitzpatrick have repeated time and again their intention to just tell the story of the Gospels. They insisted that that was what they wanted to do, just tell the story of the Bible. And this unique feature was intended to lend, I'm now quoting from an interview, to lend even more authority and realism to the movie. Such claims of authenticity especially respond to the popular expectation that this movie is not interpreting biblical events. It is not interpreting biblical events, but represents them as immediately as possible. However, so the actors speak Aramaic and Latin, but the prevalent languages in the Roman province Judea were not Aramaic and Latin, but Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek. People only in the Western portion of the empire would have spoken Latin, but in the East they would have spoken Greek. Well, that's just a minor detail. I still wanted to mention it. What I rather want to focus on is how Christ and the meaning of the Passion is actually depicted in this movie. I put that at the center of the presentation. This is one of the opening sequences of the movie. It is a quotation from Isaiah 53. It says, "He was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. By his wounds we are healed." In this song, overall, the servant of God is despised and rejected, wounded and bruised, oppressed. He suffers in silence and is eventually killed. So far, it just looks like one other miserable career and a total failure. But then the surprise, the suffering and death of the servant are said to have healed others and eliminated their sins. So Gibson and Fitzpatrick obviously suggest that this somehow explains the suffering of Jesus Christ and explains how this suffering can be of salvific meaning for humans and for us today. In particular, this motto is the chief reason why there's all the graphic depiction of violence in this movie. We know that Gibson used all sorts of imaginable means to expose the physical suffering of Jesus and to show its unimaginable amount. The result is ceaseless and increasing graphic depiction of violence, detailed close-ups, recurring slow motion, really slow motion. One example is, for instance, that in the courtyard, the flagellation scene lasts more than 10 minutes, and Jesus receives 99 blows. By the way, back then, 40 blows were considered fatal. So how exactly is Jesus supposed to have saved the world, according to Gibson? Well, Satan appears while Jesus prays in Gethsemane. Satan seeks to lure him from this undertaking by asking, "Do you really believe that one man can bear the full burden of sin?" Satan appears in the shape of a serpent. Jesus responds, "Shelter me, O Lord." Satan concludes, "No man can carry this burden, no." This is like a bet between Satan and Jesus. And, well, Jesus happens to win this bet. He carries the burden, and he endures the suffering until his death. So it is all about suffering. What do these images convey? This is Jesus after the flagellation. Who might this be? Huh? Excuse me? Okay, that's what you could assume. Let's go on. And I guess you're saying that because he wasn't bloody, right? There were no signs of torture on him. So this is now the actor who plays Jesus on the cross. And he was obviously crucified with some criminals. What do these images suggest? Here we have them side by side. You see that Jesus on the left doesn't look very good. The other guy has a little bit of blood kind of dripping down here, his arm. And obviously, Gibson wants to argue a case here. If we look at this closely, he wants to argue that the suffering of Jesus was unparalleled in terms of quality and quantity. Which is interesting because, well, certainly Jesus has been displayed in the movie like that, but there's no evidence of this in the Gospels. Okay, so once again, Gibson says he only wants to portray the story of the Gospels, but in the Gospels, Jesus is crucified amidst two criminals, so he's certainly not the only one to have suffered this punishment. And does he even suffer as much? Well, the Gospels say that he died the afternoon of his death. And that means he died relatively early. And so there's not even a reason to assume that Jesus suffered longer or more than other people who were crucified. So the summary of this is, however, according to Gibson's movie, that Jesus wins the battle against Satan. And this is how he brings about salvation. Let me just throw in a few reflections on crucifixion. It is true that crucifixion was a terrible way of killing somebody, actually not just of killing somebody, but also of torturing somebody. We see here some of the details. The person who was to be executed would carry usually only the patibulum, which is the horizontal beam, to the crucifixion side. There were two shapes of the cross possible. One is called the T-shaped cross, and the other one, I mean, you have them down here, okay? The one is the T-shape, and the other one is actually the cross-shaped cross. The charge would be attached on top of the cross. It's called the titulus in Latin. Crucifixion was very violent, and that's because it didn't really kill anybody on the spot. These large nails were driven through the feet and the hands, and obviously would cause blood loss, but no immediate death. When asked exactly how... crucifixion was therefore considered the highest punishment possible in the Roman Empire. It was in Latin called summum supplicium, that just means the highest punishment. And several aspects contributed why it was considered that way. Crucifixion caused excruciating pain, and medical doctors at some point have determined the cause of death during crucifixion. So according to a medical journal, they wrote the actual cause of death by crucifixion was multifactorial and varied somewhat with each case. But the two most prominent causes probably were hypovolemic shock and exhaustion asphyxia. That's a lot of technical terminology. Is there some medical doctor here in the audience by any chance, or a medical student who's majoring in medicine? I'm just curious who could help us with some of that language. Not really? Then I'll try it myself. Hypovolemic shock refers to probably the whole stress inflicted on the person to be executed, and that was already coming out of the flagellation, so of the torture portion of it. Exhaustion, asphyxia, means asphyxia, that you're short of breath or actually suffocate. And exhaustion simply because that person nailed to the cross would need to support the weight on the pierced limbs, and that's of course painful. And so you're fighting between suffocating on the one hand because you're kind of hanging there and you can no longer breathe properly, and on the other hand by, you know, supporting your weight on the pierced limbs and thus worsening the wounds and losing more blood. So that's one reason why crucifixion was particularly terrible and considered summum supplicium, so the highest punishment. There are other reasons too. It was a way of executing somebody which would extend human suffering up to 3 days. By the way, the corpse was sometimes left on the cross to be devoured by predatory animals. So there was not necessarily a burial following crucifixion. And then it was the special penalty for slaves, which is why in Latin it was also called servile supplicium. So how come we barely know about this? After all, Jesus is crucified and we learn about this in the Bible. How come we are not really aware of any of these bloody and terrible details of crucifixion? Well, when we open our Bibles, there is a little bit of a surprise. The flagellation in the New Testament is mentioned, yes, but Matthew just has it very shortly. So Pilate released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, he handed Jesus over to be crucified. It's only mentioned in passing. It actually just counts four words, both in the English and the Greek text. Mark, and after flogging Jesus, Pilate, okay, four words. John, also just four words. So we see actually that there's no intention of the New Testament authors to even dwell on the flagellation as such. It's certainly not 10 minutes and 30 seconds as it is in Gibson's movie. And so, according to the New Testament, the Passion actually is somewhat different. According to the New Testament, the emphasis is not on the suffering of Jesus, not on its unique quality or quantity. The emphasis is rather on the fact that Jesus had died. And the reason is also because for the New Testament and for the Gospel authors, the point is actually not the death of Jesus. It is the resurrection. And as you can easily guess, as you can easily guess, the point of the resurrection is that somebody actually has died. And so that's why for the Gospels it is important to state that Jesus in fact had died. The resurrection then becomes the victory over death. The resurrection becomes the victory and the celebration of life. That is where the New Testament heads. I should say that there is a lot of discussion then, and I haven't really addressed that at all, about the Gibson movie being quite anti-Semitic because of how the Jews are portrayed in that movie. Interestingly enough, a rabbi was once asked, so how exactly do you view the Gibson movie? And the response was, well, I personally think that it's actually anti-Christian, says the rabbi, it's anti-Christian, because it is quite clear to me that Gibson didn't really know what to do with the resurrection at all. I said earlier that I had the opportunity of talking to Fitzpatrick, the co-screenplay writer, and he actually said that he, Fitzpatrick, insisted that the resurrection scene gets into the movie. And the simple argument he used, well, it's in the Bible, okay? Because Gibson didn't want it in there. For him, it was only important to actually depict the suffering and the death of Jesus. And we see that that's actually where the movie comes to a natural conclusion, given the bet, the initial bet between Jesus and Satan, that Jesus will not be able to take on all the suffering for others. Jesus does so, and that's when the bet is won. The power of Satan is broken by this bet. The resurrection as such doesn't have any real significance according to the movie here. As I said, a Jewish rabbi found this anti-Christian. I want to conclude my reflections at this point. You had some graphic impressions of the movie. I'll shut this here down, and then we'll have David conclude or continue, and then we'll enter into an ongoing discussion here.
Thanks so much, Chris. I hope many of you had the opportunity to hear the two lectures earlier today. Dr. Eberhardt told me earlier that he took on this theme, the exploration in both Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, as a work that the church desperately needed done. And he won my heart in that moment. His lectures today have been superb, so it would be lovely if all of you could hear them. The superb cinematography of Mel Gibson's film, its brilliant color and high aesthetic values, have had a very broad appeal. But the immediacy of this encounter with Jesus' suffering and death particularly touched the hearts of evangelical Protestants. 50 years ago, it would have been unimaginable in North America, absolutely unimaginable, that the evangelical wing of the Christian community would flock to a film that used the template of the Stations of the Cross. The Stations We're then identified as Roman Catholic, clearly, rooting salvation history in suffering and death, while evangelicals open themselves to the spiritual meaning of the Passion and the Crucifixion. They understood these events through the lens, largely through the lens of the resurrection. It's a curious cultural shift. There is a deep set of questions hidden from view as the debate about the film sort of skittered about on the surface of modern cultural wars. The questions I wish to consider are rooted in the long-standing issue of the representation of Jesus Christ in the whole history of image in Western Europe and North America. They're important because they invite us to consider how we engage suffering, our own and that of others, how we view victim and perpetrator, and where we stand in relationship to both of them. So these questions are posed in a new context and brought into sharp relief by the Passion of the Christ. I was astonished and shocked that within 2 months of the launch of the film, 5 Muslim countries began to show this film. It is the first time that a film depicting a prophet, for Jesus is a prophet in Islam, has been shown in Muslim countries. It is a major no-no. But in this case, it moved forward. The usual prohibition was lifted by the mullahs in an official way. Everywhere that Hollywood casts its flood of images, the minds and hearts of people are awash in the popular culture of spectacle and death. An enormous number of films bring spectacle and death together, for they seem to be a surefire winner at the box office. So it's not surprising that a culture of victimization has also been nurtured by the same film industry and popular media, both the culture of spectacle and death and the culture of victimization require, as a matter of clarification and self-understanding, that we examine the Passion of the Christ in light of the cultural context where Christians live out their faith and shape their relationship to the life of the world. The memory and the imagination of Christians, as well as everyone else, Christians certainly, has been shaped and reshaped by artistic images of the Passion, and Gibson's film stands in a long line. Mel Gibson's use of this tradition of Passion images is my point of departure for thinking about how the representation of Jesus shapes our understanding of the gospel and the prism through which we see the life of the world. Just look at what Dr. Eberhardt just showed in terms of that text about flogging. Is it not the case that the representations of Jesus Christ that we come to treasure and contemplate shape the way we represent the meaning of Christ's life? Do our representations of Jesus Christ also frame our view of the world? Does their imprint formed within our mind and heart lead us to bond with the suffering servant as a Promethean hero of a divine ordeal, as Gibson would have it? What does this imprint do to our view of the perpetrators? What sort of vision is established in this imprint? And how does it shape our way of seeing the life of the world? The Passion of the Christ is not a film in the normal sense. Rather, Mel Gibson has carefully crafted a set of tableaux vivants, of living images of the Stations of the Cross. This Roman Catholic devotion that began in the 12th century as a way of accenting the humanity and suffering of Jesus. It goes back to the Crusaders. The Crusaders who had journeyed to reconquer the holy city of Jerusalem for the faith, as it was argued, brought this piety back to Western Europe. In Jerusalem, they had discovered the pathways where Jesus and the disciples had walked. They discovered the Garden of Gethsemane, the places of his trials and scourging, the way of sorrows to Calvary, and finally the hill of the skull itself. These were, and still are, of course, places of memorial. Pilgrims to these places bring their sorrows. I don't know how Lutherans understand that, those of you who are Lutherans, but certainly in Catholic and Orthodox countries, every time you go to pilgrimage sites, you see this really writ large. Pilgrims to these places bring their sorrows. They seek understanding and healing, and at least for some, find joy in remembering their great salvation. For others, the experience has deepened their sense of being a victim. Instead of healing, they have absorbed the suffering of Jesus into their own suffering. It's a kind of inflation, mythic inflation of suffering that occurs. Salvation, that lovely word we have in English with its Greek origins, that word for healing, has escaped them. Many crusaders were touched deeply, no doubt, by walking these pathways of memory and brought these memories back with them, layered into the trauma of their war experience. It is in this context that the Stations of the Cross were born in Christian piety. Their representations have come down to us through 800 years and continue as an important Roman Catholic devotional piety. It is through the Stations of the Cross that the various liturgies of Holy Week that we can witness, perhaps more graphically than anywhere else in Christian practice, both the gift of representation of these central scenes in the Christian revelation and the Achilles heel, spiritual romanticism, with the re-traumatization that has all too often accompanied it. Both gift and trauma may be seen in the inner personal struggles of Christians who seek its pathways of healing and on the historical and cultural plane as well, in the relationship between those who, in the name of Christian communities, use the passion narratives against the community of Jesus' brothers and sisters, the Jews. Representations have the power to frame how we see ourselves vis-a-vis the other, since they have the power to make us present again to the meaning of the text for the healing of our understanding and the life of the world. Both Mel Gibson and his cinematographer drew representations of Christ's passion and death from a large suite of paintings and sculpture. Even a modest knowledge of representations of these events in the history of Western painting makes the Gibson film oddly familiar to many. And the power of the film, I think, is owed at least in part to drawing on this cache of remarkable artistic works. At first blush, the representations of Jesus by people like Warner Salmon and Holman Hunt, the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood by Bruegel and Bosch and Michelangelo and Caravaggio, and of course Matthias Grunewald, come to mind. Images from both the great and famous paintings in various Spanish and Mexican schools, as well as the devotional imagery of these two cultural communities, echo in the horrific journey from the Garden of Gethsemane through the trials, the scourging and mocking, along the road to Calvary, to Christ's crucifixion. Through a cunning use of these representations that float around in the memory of many in the Americas and Europe, the Passion of the Christ demands that we look at the picturesque horror of a human being in the process of being torn apart. My initial impression was that Grunewald, and perhaps Romanesque, Spanish, and Mexican passion scenes, provided the artistic model for this journey to death. Well, Bruegel and Bosch gave Gibson the scenes with soldiers and crowds. Along the way, a brief set of flashbacks in the mind of Jesus, the Virgin Mary, and Mary of Magdala gave momentary glimpses into Jesus' early life. For these, Gibson seems to have called on people like Warner Salmon and Holman Hunt, who had provided the 20th century with millions upon millions of images of their romantically handsome Jesus, which shaped and reshaped the imagination of Christians. Gibson has produced a visual passion cycle, direct from the heart. It seems to me, Christian may have something to say about this, of the Counter-Reformation theology and sensibility. The emphasis on human suffering and degradation, the infatuation with human passion and the flesh, and the use of images of particular human beings possessed by their passions and driven along the pathways of death, creates a kind of single narrative. As in so much Counter-Reformation theology, the demonic trumps genuine human struggle. While the faces are particular and gripping, they share nothing with the faces of struggling human beings whom we read about in the Gospels. Rather, the particular face is defined solely by its demonic possession. It is a stance we never see Jesus take, not along the pathways of the Galilee or at his trial, or indeed from the cross of Calvary itself. Since all human beings are in the image and likeness of God, the massification of men and of women is itself, from a Christian perspective, demonic. The great Renaissance painter Grunewald's masterpiece, the Eisenstein altarpiece in Colmar, is also reflected in the film. And like the film, it is a sermon in pictures. Grunewald's painting, some of you no doubt have seen it, is stark and shows the cross was not simply a means of execution. It was, first and foremost, as Christian alluded to, a means of torture. Grunewald's hyperrealism is matched by Gibson, but there is an extraordinary difference in the context and in the way the Eisenstein altarpiece is used that is illuminating. The altarpiece anchors the liturgical space of a worshiping community for whom the story of salvation unfolds throughout the whole of the church year. The whole of the church year. Not the passion, not the crucifixion, the whole of the church year. Because it is all a story about incarnation. The doors of the altar stand open, revealing the joyous annunciation to Mary, Jesus in his infancy and his ascension. Only during Passion Week are the doors closed, revealing the crucifixion. At midnight, when the resurrection is proclaimed, the doors open again to reveal what is at the center of the faithful's understanding of life. For the faithful, The context and orientation to life is God's work in the life of the world. They're called to pay attention to this grace that has called life forth from death, even the death of the cross. When the Passion of the Christ was released, I had no intention to go to it. Gibson's penchant for heroic violence participates far too much in the culture of death for my taste. But then I have a weak stomach. I treasure the story of Jesus and the gospel texts. On that ground alone, I would pass. Why expose my mind and heart to the enormous power of film and its ability to provide images that buried my soul's response to the reading of the texts in the context of the liturgical year? It was released in Lent. At my church, where a group of young people went to it, and the adults that took them, I asked them that question. I said, why would you want to challenge the place where these texts are prayed with this kind of performance? The revelation in the Passion of our Lord tells us to glimpse the kingdom or commonwealth of God, not pretend to be on sight 2,000 years ago while the Romans execute yet another Jew. However, the public debate on the film got my attention. There seemed to be an attempt to weave together Roman Catholic and evangelical Protestant interests. Many Jews expressed concerns that I shared, at least in the abstract, as I think any Christian would, given the pollution of the Christian tradition and the gospel by those who have launched pogroms against Jesus' brothers and sisters in his name. A perception seemed to be orchestrated, suggesting this film was yet again a battleground between secular humanists and those who claim the public mantle of faith. That's the way it was teased up in the public square. I had several requests to reflect on the film, and those dovetailed with this debate in my mind. So I went. And of course, I sat down and was greeted by the words of the fourth song of the suffering servant in Isaiah 52. The film unfolded, and my questions grew. What was I seeing? What was I seeing here? A testament or a confession? A work of personal piety or a revisiting of as it was? The task of testament, and all of you who read the Gospels know this, the task of testament is not to point to itself, but to point to the kingdom of God. Not to return us to the trauma as if it was our trauma and teach us to recite it. Such approaches, I think, lead to the culture of victimization and create the circumstances that have occasioned all too often pogroms. Within the Christian tradition, there is plenty of wisdom about the dangers of spiritual romanticism. Yet the brilliant and powerful cinematography, the use of Aramaic and Latin, it was church Latin, I believe, which I was charmed by, I must say, the idea of Jesus speaking church Latin. They present the film as an extended public interest broadcast, married to the action movie and to fantasy genre. These are tried and true means of providing the public with a diet of fear and fright, which, in my view, is the diet of the devil's view of the world. Perfect love casts out fear. It is the gospel. I have learned enough from the church fathers and spiritual mothers to know that I am to guard my eyes against such invasions of the human imagination. What was I hearing here? Gibson noted that the problem many will have with the film, he said this time and time again, is not with the film itself, but with the gospel. This was his way of framing this in terms of secular humanists versus religious voices. It has been an all too popular theological notion that God killed Jesus to redeem human beings. A kind of horrendous reshaping of the gospel of love. Theologians counter this notion by saying that God snatched life from death, even the death of God in Christ. For human beings who have glimpsed their salvation, even their sin may seem to be part of their redemption, since through it they have come to glimpse God's grace. Shall we continue in sin, then, so that grace may abound? God forbid. The notion that God was a Christ killer. As if this abstract teaching stood as some sort of divine plan from before the foundations of the world, has the danger of diverting our eyes from the existential reality of experiencing our entrance into death as healed by Christ dying and rising and freeing us to be mortal. There is a reason that the Eastern Christian Church has prohibited the depiction of Christ except in icons that carefully point not to the suffering but to the grace-filled life. For the cross is the tree of life. There is a reason Orthodoxy has never had a tradition of passion plays, as we have had in the West, based on the Crusaders' dramatization. And that the acting out of the role of Jesus has been viewed in the Christian East as spiritually, theologically, and pedagogically deeply problematic. The text of the Gospels and of the Passion is simply too precious and too powerful not to be engaged in any other way except prayer. And that prayer together in the communion of the faithful. It is too powerful to be engaged any other way, because in all other ways it quickly devolves to spiritual romanticism, which offers a kind of simulacrum, a shadowy likeness, and a deceptive substitute. This story, this text, the church tells us, is to be prayed and done so together at this time of year, with the gathered community throughout Holy Week and Pascha, the Feast of Freedom, the Feast of Resurrection. It is in no sense a spectacle. So, say something.
Thanks, David, for your insights and your reflections from the Orthodox tradition, which has a very strong emphasis on incarnation, which is something which I think the Western Christian tradition has a hard time with. I was once tempted to write an article just on incarnation because I noticed that was so weak in our own perception, and there I take myself as a representative of the Western Christian tradition that I was very much tempted to yet engage another piece which I knew little about and which I felt the church needed to know something more about. I appreciated your comments because they also showed us I'm trying to avoid the term dangerous, but maybe I'll choose the strong term for the moment about dangerous ways of saying this is what Christianity is all about. And you have obviously used strong terms, so I'm just picking them up from you. I concluded by saying that Christianity is less about the suffering of Jesus, and the gospel, the news about the salvation in Jesus Christ is less about the suffering of Jesus. It is certainly about the death of Jesus, but it all aims toward the resurrection of Jesus. That's where, after all, the Gospels conclude. And I want to actually then just agree with what you said. There is this dangerous overemphasis on the suffering and of just basically saying Christianity is all about this dead person. Now, we have to see that Christianity is also about this dead person. But I tell you one story. Once a missionary or an evangelist expressed uneasiness or said, you know, actually we Christians have it very hard, he said actually to a group of people. He said, you know, because our task is to go around and proclaim Christ, the gospel about Christ. And he said, well, actually that means that we're always running around with a coffin with a dead body in there, and it's just not very attractive, you know, and that's why I think actually we do have a pretty hard task. I've come to realize that just stuck in my mind because it was such a, well, first of all, hideously ugly example or image, but then also because later on I couldn't forget it, and then later on learned to actually come to a new perception of this. And I don't think that this is what Christianity is all about. Let me say that, yes, the cross is at the center of Christianity. The cross is on all of our churches. But few people today know that the cross was, in the first place, always empty. Why empty? Why was there nobody attached to it? Because initially, when the cross was made the center of Christianity, it was always a sign of resurrection. There was no intention of ever putting a dead body on it. When a body was ultimately attached to it, and that was much later, I think we're talking about the time of 1000 CE, the body was always detached, and it was usually a blessing, Christ, so not a dead Christ. And it was once again, just centuries later, that the Christ was then depicted in an obviously dead fashion and with lots of blood over him. And I think it was also more prevalent in the Catholic tradition, probably out of the historical circumstances that David described to us. It was out of the trauma of a church which has just sent out its soldiers to conquer the Holy Land. Let me also say that obviously the church, the cross is not the only symbol of Christianity. So while the cross initially was a symbol of resurrection, which is why it was empty, it was obviously predated by something different, and that's the fish. You remember this little thing, and sometimes you see it on cars, on the bumper. It also stands for Christianity today, but was the main symbol of Christianity throughout the first three centuries. We're, by the way, not talking about a dead fish, not some kind of tuna in a can, but we're really talking about a live fish, and fish usually swim upstream, right? I mean, when they're well alive. You might also have heard about this, that it's actually kind of Greek, and it's the Greek word is ichthys, and that means that Jesus is the Christ, and he's the Son of God, and he is the Savior. Why I mention this here is that at some point there was something at the heart of Christianity which wasn't even as ambivalent as the cross. It was the fish, which doesn't mean that the death of Jesus saved us. It means Jesus is the Savior. It's a small difference, but I think it's a crucial difference, that it does therefore include the entire mission of Jesus, starting now with the incarnation, including the life of Jesus, certainly not omitting the death of Jesus, but then also once again including the resurrection of Jesus. If we confess that Jesus is the Savior, then we're not just looking at somebody who has been beaten up Now, while that is true, that is not the only and exclusive essence of Christianity. So the good news is much larger than that. It is a transition from death to life. And it will conclude on Easter Sunday, on Easter Monday, and when life is celebrated. New life beyond death. That is what Christianity is all about. And I think that's what is misrepresented in Gibson's movie.
There's just a couple things that I ponder as you're speaking, Christian. And there may be illustrative of the different ways that the whole of the church has handled this. In the Christian East, you have icons of the crucifixion going back. Well, of course, the iconoclast removed most of them from the picture, but we have a few still from the 6th and 7th century. What is interesting about them is that Jesus Christ is never shown suffering in them. He is shown as grace-bearing. He is shown as sanctifying, even dying, which is, of course, part of the amazing part of this revelation. Christ's, Athanasius said, God has become human so that human beings may become divine. That doesn't refer to power. It refers to the capacity for compassion so that human beings can live not in terms of their own ego, but in terms of their love of the other, which is the restoration of the fullness of the human nature. We were made for blessing and healing, and we lose that because of our fear of death, our fear of our mortality. So Christ's life, passion, death, and resurrection is both model and teacher of the whole process whereby human beings can actually be restored to their God-given nature as those who tend the garden of creation, who have the capacity to bless and heal. It's interesting, in Orthodox ritual, I could take you this evening out to Bluffton, which is an hour and a half from here, where there's a little woman's monastery, which has existed really for most of the 20th century. And there's a bishop buried out there. He was buried back in 1923. And we could go up to his grave, and you look at his grave, and it says in Russian, Vladika Yosef, nailed down on the 13th of October, 1925. In the liturgical life, the life of prayer, the crucifixion also informs our struggle, our life. And so the human being is woven into this. In Pascha, the whole Pascha liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, the whole of Holy Week, is exactly the same as a funeral for me when I die, or for anyone else. It's the same. Why is it the same? Because Christ's death and my death are wedded to each other. Because Christ is the second Adam, restores the human nature. My nature, your nature. So within the liturgical life, there is all of this use of this extraordinary part of the story. But it is not used to speak either of 2,000 years ago, to allow that narrative to be captured by the past. But rather, it is a revelation. It reveals part of the mystery of our experience as human beings. Because all of us, I think, find ourselves one day or another in Gethsemane. And all of us, one day, are in the tomb. So, that extraordinary revelation that we have of the passion and death of Christ has a fundamental spiritual, is fundamentally spiritually illuminating of human experience and gives some shape and form and some language for that.
So, should we at this point, yeah, invite the audience to join in, to comment, to ask questions, whether you've seen the movie or not. It, you know, can be regarding the movie, but it can also go beyond that.
Jonathan.
Yes.
And a common one, and I assume this is a variant of the substitutionary atonement, sort of like somebody had died, or it was Jesus instead of us. So, but there are other theories saying that that really is kind of a bizarre view of, like, why would God demand that somebody die? It's a misinterpretation of the sacrifice theology of the Old Testament, for example. Is it not really, some would suggest, a kind of inevitable that Jesus would die, because any radical who takes on the established powers of institutions of their day and tries to call it to account for greater justice tend to be rolled over and killed. That really the pivotal fact was that in the resurrection, God vindicated Jesus' teaching and ministry in spite of the institutions, including the church.
Yes, so that the question is somewhat, you know, on the one hand, theories of atonement, which then easily go in the direction of having God being the divine planner of all of this, or the divine institutor of all of that, and that obviously impacts our understanding of God quite substantially, versus actually what I said today over lunch. In that presentation, what are the historical reasons, according to the Gospels, why Jesus died? And yes, was the crucifixion necessary? At least it was inevitable for somebody who was as radical as Jesus in a nonviolent resistance movement. So I was trying to make that clear. Jesus used some, well, you know, he went into the temple and whatever means he employed there weren't always nonviolent, but overall Jesus was committed to a nonviolent movement. But in that kind of situation, it was clear that he would face the opposition of the political and of the religious governing class, and there were others around him who got killed for exactly the same, John the Baptizer being just one of them. So how do these two compare? Atonement theories have been used exactly, and you concluded on that note, precisely because that death wasn't vindicated. Jesus so did resurrect, and that suggested that the death was something different. By the way, sometimes I think the church would do well in remembering a little bit more just the historical circumstances why Jesus died, the ones I try to map out today, because it really, as in and of itself, shows the mission of Jesus. Jesus didn't just come to die a salvific death for others and resurrect afterwards. There was more to this, and the proof is simply that the story about this more, the story about this life of Jesus, is quite long in the Gospels. There are some New Testament theologians who say, well, the Gospels are just a passion story with an overly long introduction. I would challenge that view, and I would say that the Gospel authors knew pretty well why they wrote this long story about the life of Jesus. Okay, so I think that is important, therefore. By the way, those New Testament scholars are then maybe informed by our creed. Our creed, which mentions that Jesus was obviously born by the Virgin Mary, never lived, but was, you know, then suffered under Pontius Pilate and crucified and was died. So what about the life? Did that count for nothing? So it's strange how sometimes we make choices in our faith statements, and obviously, you know, forget about all the healings. Forget about the speaking ministry, the proclamation of Jesus. Forget about all the things that Jesus did, how he went around and talked to people. I mean, all the things which I try to show how Jesus really made an inclusive society visible. That's all gone from our creeds. Can you believe it? But anyway, then yes, images from pretty much everywhere were picked to try to express something which was very difficult to express, that the death of Jesus could be salvific. And that's not what atonement is all about. Atonement is then images taken from the temple. I talked about this afternoon, but also from different backgrounds. It is about images from the slave market, images from policies or politics, from diplomacy, to suggest that Jesus could be viewed in a similar fashion. Sometimes I think, you know, they are so much commonplace, and they spoke to people because they were commonplace, that what we should do today is actually sometimes just try to reinvent a new image of atonement according to what is commonplace today. So maybe, you know, choose, I don't know, computer language, you know, and try to come up with a new atonement image just as a good exercise. And also to then see whether we understood what atonement was all about. But this is how atonement concepts relate to the actual historical circumstances of the death of Jesus. They are not exactly the same.
One little footnote to this. Substitutionary atonement, I mean, Anselm being such a great articulator of it, leads one to see Jesus coming into the world on a juridical mission to satisfy God's justice and make it possible for God's love to function again. But there is a rich vein in the church which says, oh no, this is no juridical mission. This is a medical mission. It's a healing mission. It is about salvation. It is about the healing of the human person and the human family and the relationship between enemy and enemy. So it is seen as God's way of finally showing human beings who they really are. The second Adam. He's the second Adam. This, I'll just emphasize this again. Certainly within the spiritual tradition of Christian churches, the crucifixion is also understood, or the God's dying is understood to be, of course, the final way in which death is slain. Again, I don't know if you do it in the Lutheran Church, I think you may these days, but in St. John Chrysostom's liturgy on Friday night, on Great and Holy Friday and Saturday, after the vigil, the whole church is a tomb. Everybody is outside. And they bang on the door. You see this in Orthodox churches all over the world. Usually priests injure their arms doing it. They bang on the door. Look at any Orthodox church door, and you'll see the dents in it. And they chant out, Christ is risen from the dead. Trampling down death by death. Why? Because our great problem, a great spiritual problem for human beings, and the whole of the Bible, this is one of the golden strands of it, is that we are afraid to be mortal. And we are called to be mortal. So Christ restores our mortality to us. We don't have to pretend to be God.
Thanks for the footnote. Any other questions? Yes, please.
I'm thinking about all of today. And I think one of my frustrations right now is that
how do we keep the story alive? If and maybe that was a way of trying to show a new dimension in, you know, in the Jesus story. The problem is that something which Gibson doesn't really admit, has admitted very occasionally, is that his story is not at all new. Actually, the story which he's writing is by and large the story of a Catholic nun. What was her name? Katharina Emmerich, who lived in a monastery somewhere in Germany. And it's a very traditional Catholic view of the crucifixion. By the way, even the title of the Gibson movie is exactly the book title of Emmerich's, this Catholic nun's book. If you just kind of take out every second word, you actually come to the Passion of the Christ. I'm just trying to remember it. It's in my article and I don't remember it anymore. I think it's the Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ. Maybe I missed one word. So if you take out Dolorous and then of Our Lord, then you're coming to the Passion of the Christ. While I think you're right, I mean, it's a constant way of trying to come to the original meaning of the text or to find new ways of what the text could mean. I think the Gibson movie does precisely the opposite. It just sits there in its own tradition and pretends that's all there is. If it would have done that, it would have maybe looked at new venues of expressing that, but I think it's doing exactly not this, and it's dramatically manifest in the fact that he's just writing up this, or actually, you know, putting on stage this old 150-year-old book from this Catholic nun. Also looking at the impact the movie had, I remember that the movie then was hailed as a big evangelistical tool. And I think there was almost maybe a hope that, you know, lots of people would convert themselves, and reportedly that's not been the case. I heard that there was a percent who said this movie had an impact on them, which is not a whole lot, especially if you also take into consideration something which was never really counted, is how many people got thoroughly grossed out with Christianity by having watched this movie. So by the time you balance the two, we could probably state, I'd be careful, you know, the movie didn't have any impact. So even if Gibson was trying to do that, you know, then he went the wrong way, and obviously the result of it didn't really do anything. So it didn't turn out to be the big evangelistic, you know, revival of North America, certainly not. There must be different ways of doing that.
Christ is the bridegroom. Christ is the bridegroom. And creation is the bride. So, this narrative is all about love. And in some sense, as many of the spiritual writers and theologians as well in the church have made an enormous amount out of this. I was charmed by your comment about the long introduction to the Passion in the Gospels. What is all that about? It's all healing stories. It's healing physical, mental, psychological, spiritual illness. It's all healing stories. Over and over and over again. That's why the Christian church in its early embodiment was often considered a medical cult. Because it was preoccupied with the healing. And that's Christian tradition has a wonderful way of speaking about the bridegroom courting us. And we find this in all wings of the Christian tradition. Evangelical, Brethren, Pentecostal, as well as Catholic, Lutheran, Orthodox, Calvinist, we find the image there. It's a question about how central it is. But this image that God is pursuing us as our lover.
wants only our wholeness, wants us only to become who we are, so that creation can be, instead of having us remake the world out of our own passion, out of our own suffering, instead of entering into communion with the gift of life. So it is a shame that that particular set of images has been so dominant. But the tradition, it is not the dominant image in the whole of the tradition. There is an enormous image or set of images associated with the bridegroom and love. As a matter of fact, in the iconographic tradition of the Christian East, the crucifixion icon is called the bridegroom. It's called the bridegroom because the bridegroom lays down his life for his beloved.
Why is it that during the history of the church that the Western tradition called the individual mission, and in these days of the human mission, was there no traditional tradition in the Greek Orthodox?
Well, the standard argument, I mean, you can take it with a grain of salt. When Orthodox thinkers start apologizing for their position over against the West, you've always got to be a little careful. But I'll give you one of the standard ways that tradition responds to this. And it's that Anselm of Canterbury and that whole wing of the church going up into Western Europe was feudal. And it was... It was also, if you will allow the term, archaic. You know, Christianity is born in Palestine within a sophisticated Greek culture. The Greek church fathers read that language. So for them, the whole struggles around superstition, the struggles around demons, all of that, I would argue, ended very quickly in the Christian East. But when Christianity goes north, it ends up in and begins to Christianize Western Europe. I mean, it's there in very minor presence, of course, early, but when it really becomes dominant, it has entered a very different world from the Greek world. It has entered a world which has no, at least by Greek standards, sophisticated philosophical framework. It has entered a world, and we see this in the great Luther. It has entered a world which is full of demons, which is full of bargaining with deities, which it then baptizes. And I think, in part, Western Europe's only getting over this now.
Well, I mean, Christianity is always needs to be understood within the context in which it develops, which is what David just said, and certainly very strong in the Western Roman Empire were the legal structures, which is then also why much of Christianity came around and it came across as quite legalistic. So, you know, just to add on to that, this one idea. And certainly, as you also said, yes, I mean, I said it earlier already, education, the educational level, by and large, actually decreased for quite some time. We are wrong to assume that literacy levels, for instance, and education were just, you know, gradually developing from back then until now. There is some evidence that actually literacy levels, for instance, were pretty high during the first, second century, but then dropped dramatically and reached certain, you know, lows at the time of the medieval times. I can't provide the precise numbers. But so that means that it will also have ramifications then on how the Christian message, the religion, I mean, the concepts that were constructed for a religion, the philosophical concepts that were built on it, could be perceived and could be passed on. within a certain culture. So, you know, all of these things impact how Christianity then, or any other religion, is being presented to the people, how its actual shape is. And so, as David just said, things have been quite different than in the East from the West.
Now, that is not simply a critique of the West. All you have to do is go to Orthodox churches and you'll understand the value of having a good juridical process, understanding the value of having a good bureaucratic process. The greatest witness to the significance of the Latin Church is, in fact, the Orthodox Church. But in the Orthodox Church, it has very wide margins of mess. But it is also the case that Greeks are just very different than Romans. You know, they are much more inclined to put up with things than we found in Rome, and they never ruled in the same very strict way. I mean, the Roman Church is an enormous issue now on its hands because the encyclical, which is a teaching letter for bishops, is now published in the New York Times. This was never meant to be driven. Policy was never meant, I would argue, to be driven down to the parish level. It was meant to sit as ideal, as aspiration. But you drive it all the way down, which is what has happened, and you end up proving that old dictum that perfection is the enemy of the good. Well, you have to appreciate that the Byzantine Empire lasted 1,000 years longer than the Western Roman Empire. The Byzantine Empire is East Roman. It's a different cultural framework. There's a continuity with the language of the New Testament. It's in the East. It's not in the West. So these are remarkable different features to how those two churches develop. And I think you have church fathers. I mean, if you look at somebody like Basil the Great, who was, if you'll pardon my French, a really hard-assed monk, but at the same time, absolutely preoccupied with what the gospel is about, soterios, healing. The gospel is about healing. It is to see that human beings come to the fullness of their nature. So that's pretty dramatic. It's not as if that isn't in the West. It clearly is, but it's a question of emphasis. Thanks.
Thank you. I want to say one last word of thanks to David and Christian for being here and for sharing your passion in the sense of the word as it means love for the church and for your discipline and what it means for to be human in this world. As I mentioned at the beginning of this week, for those from the Christian tradition, we will experience a lot of the death and crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus through ritual and prayer, and it is good also to think about those images as well too as we experience this week. So thank you very much for your presence and your time.